VorpalNetwork.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, it's Jeff Greiner from The Tome Show here, and I'm bringing you a special episode straight from D&D Experience 2011. It's the second biggest D&D convention of the year. This is an unedited Wizards of the Coast session from the con. I've had some people being really fantastic about going to those sessions and recording them and sending them on to me, and so I get to share them with you. Just a quick look. Couple of quick reminders while you're listening to this. If you're listening within the first few months of 2000, or the first half, I'd say, of 2011, we have a contest going on. Go to thetomeshow.com and find a link to the contest page for all the details, where you can win prizes from Aaliyah Tools, Noble Knight Games, Sonic Legends, Obsidian Portal, Q Workshop, Gnome Stew, Sly Flourish, Epic Words, and more yet to be announced. So check those out. Also, I wanted to remind you that this episode, like all the latest Tome Show episodes, are brought to you by Noble Knight Games. Check them out, and if you happen to buy some stuff, make sure you tell them that the Vorpal Network sent you.
Noble Knight Games has been serving the needs of thousands of gamers worldwide since 1997. With a huge selection of over 30,000 unique products, including discounts on most in-print games of up to 50% off or more. Noble Knight Games is the place for out-of-print RPGs, board games, war games, collectible card games, miniatures, and all things game-related. They ship worldwide and will purchase or trade your titles you no longer need, new, or used. Your satisfaction is guaranteed. Just visit www.noblenight.com or visit our website for direct access to thousands of new, out-of-print, and in some cases, one-of-a-kind items.
There's one question, those of you that are here. But you may wind up actually asking more than one question today, depending on how long it takes for Mike to answer his question.
Those are not the rules.
Yes. But so we have Trevor Kidd, who's Wizards Community. We have Chris Perkins, who's producer, senior producer at D&D R&D. And we have Mike Merles, who's D&D R&D group manager here today.
We also have Chris Tulock, who, for lack of a better word, is a D&D organized play guru, because I don't think his title doesn't do him justice. But
yeah.
that's
so. Anyway, yeah, that's. I'm actually just here to kind of kick it off, and then I'm just going to leave these guys.
But that was more of a slap shot.
Yeah, it was.
It's also true that we have certain specialties and certain things we have absolutely no knowledge about.
Yeah.
So I'll just warn people about that in advance.
Yeah. You regret to say we have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, yes. You regret the right. And you can ask these guys any question you want about anything, but they can respond with, I don't know, or...
We reserve the right to tell a rambling story.
Yes. Yes. Especially Mike.
We can also
a personal question.
I'm gonna just let you guys kick it off then.
Everyone sends throws questions.
You're gonna leave, aren't you, Chris? You're leaving.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. I'm not required to be here, and therefore I'm going to...
I was going to point out, Chris doesn't love you as much as we do.
We don't want you here.
I have to be somewhere.
The door.
You're
forcing me to be here.
Right, I'll sit in for Chris.
Okay. I can answer the OP questions, right?
Perfect.
Great, works
for me.
Let's start the back.
Oh.
All right.
Oh.
Okay.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I'm really kind of a professional forum lurker, so I was just coming to listen. I really didn't have to. I do have something, though. And, what, in your mind, is either the biggest misconception or the biggest misinformation about the current edition of Dungeons & Dragons that's out there? If there's one thing you can say, correct,
only one thing. That's,
stop.
There's one question.
Well, so it's, I think at the end of the day, the one thing I wish, I don't know if this is directly answered as far as a misconception, but if people would actually play the game first. Like, go into it honestly, without the sort of, well, given that this game is an MMO, I'm going to act like it's MMO, and then complain that the players act like it was an MMO, and then never play it again. You know, I think that being that sort of attitude about it, I mean, I think this is something from the beginning, just those preconceptions people have that they've heard from other people who hadn't played it, who heard it from other people who hadn't played it, who haven't even looked at the game. You know, just getting to the point of that, like getting people just to play it and enjoy the game for what it is, instead of having these weird expectations going into it, or having these things built up in their minds about what they're expecting, and then acting on that before really even seeing the game. I've heard plenty of stories from retailers of, you know, people who are in their stores, who badmouth 4th edition, hate it, don't want to play it, can't find groups for whatever other games. Maybe they sit down and try playing it, and then they realize, oh, this is nowhere near as bad as I thought it was. It's pretty fun. It's D&D, and they can enjoy it. So I think really it's just that those preconceptions that just get out there, you know. And I guess maybe on Wizard's part, it's just early on being more aggressive and addressing those and showing off the game and the mechanical changes and making it clear, like, hey, this is how things are changing, and it's changing in an interesting way. It's not, we're not trying to make the game into an MMO.
My answer would have been very similar. It would have been that the greatest misconception is that it's not a role, R-O-L-E, playing game anymore. And it is, because that's certainly the way I play it, and I've seen it played. And I think some of that might be because of a few of the early adventures that we released for the game were very combat-focused. And I think that sort of appealed to the R-O-L-L role-playing type guys a little bit more. So some of it was our own fault for not making our adventures more diverse, but it is a misconception. And
the thing that I would want to address is, like, in the past couple months, with us like removing some products from the calendar or us changing how we're doing things for DDI, people started saying, "Oh my gosh, D&D's doing horrible. D&D's sinking. Get off the ship." And it's just not true. We changed the way we're doing some things, as Chris mentioned in his earlier product seminar yesterday. We focused kind of our products on specific themes throughout the year. We're doing a couple digital games. We're working on a movie with sci-fi. There's a lot of stuff that's going on. And for people just to start the theory crafting and be like, oh my gosh, D&D's dying, that part's just not true. So that's the one thing that I would want to make sure people hear.
Thank you very much.
Are you back?
I'm just listening.
Okay. Come forward.
That's
fine.
He's lurking. Let him lurk.
We'll let him lurk for a little while longer. Yeah, I'm coming from the back to the front.
Oh, I didn't have any questions.
Oh, no worries.
Okay,
no worries.
If there was one thing about 3rd edition you would change, what would it be? And why?
The main thing is this guy named Robert Schwab keeps writing books for them, and
yes.
I don't know why.
Tell him about the verb.
They keep hiring him. He's weird, and he makes me uncomfortable. Now, if I could change one thing, I think I'd make combat faster. Like, just flat out, just make fights go quicker. Because
so
I think.
Like,
sorry, what?
So, like, wow.
I don't understand the question.
Never heard of it. I'm. Just got asked about bilingual.
Oh.
So, I'm Richard Mock. So.
I'm sorry, what's. I can't. I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry, speaking tongues.
He's saying he's bilingual, so he's you might be having a hard time saying it.
Okay, if combat was fast, because I think that one of the things people have is that I see is that the minimum combat time is higher than some people like. So I'd like to see more flexibility there. That the shorter fight that feels interesting and compelling could be go by quicker.
Some of that's the player's fault, though. You know, they just won't get into the battle. You know, I've designed a few real easy knock them out, you know, let's go on and get through this before, you know, so we can get to the interesting part. You know, just to get their trigger hand, you know, quiet and get that out of the way. And they just won't get into the fight. So it takes an hour for really, if they had just gone in, killed them all, 10 minutes, would have been over with. Their hand would have been calm, their dice would have been happy, it would have been good. We could have gotten to the role play.
Chris?
I think my answer to that would be one thing I'd change is better content regulation. That is to say that we had some internal desires early in 4th edition to very carefully plan out when we released what and how much material, how fast. And we kind of fell into our 3rd edition trap of wanting to get so much out there so quickly that people became inundated. They had more options than they could possibly handle, more feats than they could possibly use. If I could go back and change one thing, it would be taking a hard look at how much content needs to be out in the gaming universe at a given time, and probably scaling it back.
I probably would. I mean, I'm not a designer developer, but I'd say the same thing as far as looking back what I would have liked to have seen. It's like smaller books with maybe less content or less choices. I look at the essential stuff, and some people are like, oh, essentials changes the game, but really to me, it's just that repackage it differently, and that's what I would have liked to have seen at the beginning, I think.
Next question.
Point of Where did you guys get your start in the RPG industry? I know I met Mike, not met him, but through Iron Heroes.
Yep.
And I just want to know where you guys, and I know, Chris, I don't know your story as much, but can you talk about where you guys kind of got your start and the type of games that you enjoyed playing?
Yeah, I got my start in 1999 working on a game called Unknown Armies. It's a modern conspiracy supernatural kind of game. The published by Atlas Games. This guy, John Tynes, who some of you may have heard of, who worked on Delta Green, and Greg Stolze, created this game. It was published. I got on a mailing list for fans of the game and started posting some stuff I wrote for my game on that list. And I think they had an open call or someone saw something that they wrote that they liked. They wanted to put into the source book they were doing, and that's kind of where I got my start. So from there, I worked on... Started with Unknown Armies, worked on a game called Feng Shui, which is a modern-day martial arts action movie game. Worked on some of the World of Darkness games, Vampire and Hunter, and then started doing D20 stuff. And from D20 stuff, I worked, was a full-time freelancer for a few years after that. Worked at Malhavik Press for a year. That's when I did Iron Heroes. Worked at Paizo for like four months, something like that. I did the Dragon Magazine Compendium. And then that's when I started working at Wizards, was after that.
Cool.
My story goes back to when I was 10, when I first started playing the game and realized instantly that that's what I wanted to do with my life. When I was 15, I read in Dragon Magazine about a new magazine coming out called Dungeon, which was all focused on adventures, which I really enjoyed sort of designing on my own. And shortly thereafter, I started submitting article ideas to the editors, some of which were wonderfully bad. But, you know, being 16, all the ideas are cool when you actually think about them. It's only many years later when you crack open the editor's file folders, which have your name on it, and you see what it is they thought about your submissions, you realize how humbling the whole publishing industry can be. When I was 16, I got my first article purchased by Dungeon, and it was published when I was 17. By that time, I was pretty much hooked into sending proposal after proposal after proposal, and I really inundated them with ideas. And I pretty much decided then that I would do anything that was necessary to work at TSR. It took about 5 years of submitting proposals and getting things published where I was sort of in with the editors. They knew exactly what I was capable of. They knew I was able to hit all of my deadlines. They started giving me assignments, which was a nice twist. And then one day in the summer, I decided to drive down to Lake Geneva and just show up at the TSR factory. They put me to work, basically, cleaning Brian Thompson's office and sifting through the submission pile, which they'd gotten so horribly behind that they had big, gigantic bins full of unread submissions.
Chris is like, here's all mine.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. All of these are awesome. You can just publish these as they are. Once I took mine out of the bins, I basically helped them get on top of their workload. And I hung around Lake Geneva for 2 weeks as just this guy who most of the people in the building didn't even know. And then I went back to Canada. And then I did the same thing the following year. And I think it was that experience that kept me in their thoughts. That and my dungeon adventure writing problem. I was doing a lot of writing then. And that really sort of, when Wizards of the Coast bought TSR in 1997, and several of the TSR employees decided not to make the transition, jobs opened up, they thought of me. And they asked me if I was interested in joining as Dungeon Magazine's editor, and I turned to my employer at that particular moment in time, since I was at work when I got the call, and said, I'm leaving. I was teaching at the time.
Oh.
And
wow. Sorry, kids. Peace.
Well, I was actually in the principal's office when I got the call. It was
so
very
strange. You were a teacher?
I was.
Cool. Nice.
In my last year of teaching, I taught adults who had gone back to get their high school diplomas. So it was a very good way, good note to go out on, because they were there really to learn and to keep busy. And so I moved out west and was actually here, arrived a couple days before the rest of the TSR staff did. And I stayed on Dungeon for 4.5 years or thereabouts, and also managed to pick up a couple Star Wars magazines at the same time. So I was doing 3 magazines by myself as editor and art director with no assistance except for a stuffed monkey, which the publisher gave me as a joke because I kept asking for an assistant and I never could get one. And then I joined the R&D team after that, which was probably good because the Star Wars magazines on top of the regular workload were just absolutely crazy. And it was I was looking for a change at that time. But working on Dungeon Magazine and Azure was still the best job I ever had. And I've been with R&D ever since. While I was the Dungeon Editor, random piece of trivia for you. One of the article submissions I got, and this was during the period when I discovered all the wonderful things Barbara Young and Roger Moore and the other editors had written about my submissions in the old folder that had my name on it. But I got a submission from this man.
Yeah?
Yes. Who was very interested in doing sort of a redo or a revisit of the caves of Quasqueton,
yep.
If you recall, from the old B1 adventure In Search of the Unknown. And I said no. But that's the way it goes.
Well, I'm not a designer-developer, so... No, I started playing when I was...
We just found you on the street.
Right? Yeah, I found you on the street. I started playing D&D when I was 9. It was AD&D. My best friend's older brother ran us through a game, and I played a fighter. I know you know this story, Matt. Like, here, play this. Like, okay, fine. It was awesome. The first D&D product I bought, we were talking about this yesterday, and you guys know the name of it, but I didn't. The name of the module. Rob, do you remember the name of the module we were talking about?
City of the Gods.
City of the Gods. And that was the first D&D product I'd ever bought, so I'm flipping through this adventure and I'm like, what the heck is going on? But it was awesome. Like, you have the maps and I'm like, this is really cool. Started playing second edition, started DMing my own stuff, you know, drawing maps on grid paper and running people through horrible dungeons. And
that's actually a really good question that I'd like to ask Mike. What was your first D&D product? Like, the first product you discovered that was
the Holmes Basic Set.
Oh, okay.
In 1981.
Right. What about you, Chris?
Mine was the first edition Monster Manual.
Oh, wow. That's a nice one.
I didn't even have the rules of the game, and I was playing the game just with the Monster Manual.
That is awesome. Throw the monster down. Fight that thing! Went from there, D&D, lots of stuff. Went to college, and I was going to be a chemistry major. Did that for about 2.5 years before I realized I didn't want to do math in a lab for a long time. Switched to creative writing. Picked up 3rd and 3.5 during that time. Actually had a hard time making the transition to 3.5 because I just bought all my 3 books when we did the transition to 3.5. I was like, oh, so I waited a little bit of time for that. Focused on writing and the creative stuff, and then ended up being a managing and production editor for different years for our school magazine, and then I started volunteering for literary arts magazines around the area. Didn't have a job, put my thing in for a local contract company. Got a call from a woman who asked me if I knew about Dungeons and or Dragons. That's exactly how the question was. It's like, yes, I played Dungeons and Dragons. I was like, well, would you like to come work at Witches of the Coast as a, you know, as one of their game support reps? I was like, sure. They got me in, they interviewed me, and when they interviewed the interview process, they had me sit down and play a game. And I had Star Wars Miniatures I'd never played. It was awesome. Like, the team was awesome, everything was awesome. They called me back the next day to give me the job as a contractor. They put me to work at answering phones and emails about Dungeons and Dragons, because I know more about Dungeons and Dragons than anybody else on the team except for Chris Lindsay, who's now over on the D&D brand team. Do that for a while, get hired on, do that for a while, get promoted, do that for a while, manage the team, do that for a while. Manage the community team. Chris Youngs and Steve Winter are still trying to get me to write something for Dragon or Dungeon. I'm afraid of failure, so I haven't stepped into that role yet. But communities is I'm very happy with it, with community manager, and of course I still play lots of D&D. It's one of my biggest hobbies. So
any fears of failure I had were pretty much crushed working on the magazines.
Yeah, that's what I hear from people in the industry. You have to Rob actually wrote this article about getting over your fear of failure, and how you just have to accept it. You're gonna fail. You need to embrace it and learn from it and move on. I'm just not there yet.
Let's see. I'm doing some crowdsourcing here. So this one comes from our friend Logan.
Oh, great.
No, that's a good question. So I know he says, I know that there's been some kind of old school revival in sort of some of the D&D tropes that have been coming out. But what are some current inspirations you guys find when designing stuff for the D&D game?
Like stuff like things like, so I make sure I have the question right, like what are newer things that we're inspired by?
No, absolutely.
As far as newer things go, I think when you look at, I mean, this is going to be very abstract, so bear with me. Games are in a really interesting place right now, because back in the 80s or 90s, whatever, you've talked about games, people would say, well, wouldn't it make sense to make games for women or games for girls? And people would try that, they'd just take some game and make it pink and try to sell it, and it wouldn't go anywhere. And then now that you have iPhones, iPads, the Wii, you have a complete change in the interface. Now you completely see these people who before wouldn't touch games playing them all the time now. Like, my in-laws play Wii Sports and Mario Kart on the Wii. They never would have played it on the GameCube, but they'll play it all the time on the Wii. Because the Wii, to play Mario Kart, you just take a wheel and pretend like you're driving a car with a wheel. I mean, that's not... I mean, if you've driven a car, you know how to play Mario Kart. Except for the part where you shoot shells at other people, which you normally can't do in a car. So I think that when I look at... You know, I'm not really a designer. I'm not a designer anymore, obviously, as a manager. So I do more big picture stuff. But the way I see it is D&D fills a very basic need, I think, in a lot of people. The game, when it first came out, had these completely obtuse rules. It took a lot of work to figure out actually how to play and what the game was actually like. And yet it still took off. It was, you know, it spawned an entire subculture. So I think there's something there that's just interesting to people, this idea of creating this persona, like being immersed in this world, the shared creation. And it makes me wonder, well, does D&D face something similar where we have an interface problem? Where Mario Kart on the GameCube, the only people who played it were geeks and gamers. You take that same exact game, put it on the Wii, give people a plastic steering wheel, and my 65-year-old mother-in-law plays the game now. So, and she loves it. So what is it about D&D that in the interface that we can look at? So from the modern gaming is just looking at how interfaces are breaking down those barriers. That games do have a lot of stuff that attracts these demographics, or whatever you want to call it business-wise, who are not normally thought of as game players, and yet now they're playing games in droves. You know, Farmville, you know, on Facebook, right? I mean, Farmville is just all about being social, right? It's getting your friends to help you do stuff, and it's got a lot of Skinner box kind of aspects to it. But I think what keeps people in it is that social aspect of it, of not only just, hey, come help me with my farm, but this is what my farm looks like, and what does my friend's farm look like? Well, my farm looks nicer. You know, it's just like, you know, when my wife has friends over, if it's my gamer friends, we don't have to clean the house, because the place can be a pit, because my gamer friends don't care. But if they're her friends, we have to clean the house, because she doesn't want her friends to see a house that's a dump. So, you know, it's just that kind of thing, and people just, yeah, I think it just taps into, like, these common social things people have. And I think a lot of it's just interface. A lot of it's just that social networking that's attached to it, that it's gives it that human element to these games. You know, I think if you just made Farmville as like a Nintendo game and there was no interaction with other people, no one would play that game. It would just be a way, I mean, who cares? You're just clicking buttons and growing stuff and there's no point to it. But as soon as you have that human element to it, that social element to it, now everyone wants to have the biggest farm. Or Cityville, or Frontierville, or Junkie Townville. I don't know what they're making now, but all that stuff. So I think when I think in terms of those things, I think, well, what is it about RPGs that maybe has a potential? And I don't think D&D's ever a game where you're going to have, you know, little old ladies playing it. But, I mean, I just know people who I've met who are just like, you know, this guy, you know, someone who would probably like D&D, and you ask them, why don't you play D&D? Well, it seems really complicated. I don't know anyone else who plays. I don't really... It's really daunting. You know, it's a 300-page rule book. Where do I start? Just simple things like that. Where I think if you were just, you know, it's a classic thing, right? When you teach someone to play D&D, you just sit them down and they play, and then they get it, and then they kind of, okay, now I'm ready to go. But it's almost like they need that. They need to play it first before they know that they want to play it, or that they feel that they can play it. And I think when you look at the Wii, it's something very similar, where, like, my parents, my in-laws, would love to play Mario Kart, but it wasn't until, well, you've driven a car, so you know how to play this game. You're just going to drive a car on the screen. It just happens to be a go-kart. That, okay, they can do that. But you give them a controller with, like, two little joysticks and six buttons and use this to drive a car. Well, I don't use this to drive a car. This is stupid, right? This doesn't make any sense. Why would I drive a car with this thing? They don't put this in my car. So, you know, it'll be a steering wheel. So now I give you a steering wheel. Okay, this makes sense. You know, playing with the Wii tennis. Here's a tennis racket. You know, pretend this is a tennis racket and play tennis. Okay, I can do that. I have watched tennis. I know it exists. I understand what I'm supposed to do. I'm not explaining, well, hit B and it's really funny when we play Mario Kart in the Wii, to sort of belabor that game, but they have so much trouble getting through the menus to actually play. It's all press A, select someone here, use the trigger to go back, and they're lost. Like, they just have to do it for them. But as soon as the game comes up and it's here's the steering wheel, now they can play. You know, it's just, it's all about interface to me. So.
I very much live and breathe D&D, which is to say that it's not only my job, but it's what I take home with me. It's what I think about all the time. I run two...
It's true. Too. Yeah. It's not exaggerating.
I run a campaign for two different groups of eight players each every week and spend a good deal of my quote-unquote free time thinking about what I'm going to do for that group to make it a special experience. Because the most important D&D to me is the D&D I play and the D&D experience that I'm able to share with my players. And the inspiration for that comes from all over the place. It comes from current and past movies. It comes from television series, the way television series sort of structure their seasons as far as carrying a story through different arcs, juggling multiple characters in an ensemble, essentially. How they actually technically achieve that is something I pay very close attention to. I'm very much a person who kind of disassembles how things like that are done and then try to take some of those building blocks and integrate them into my D&D experience so that I'm making sure that all of the characters in my group are growing and developing and finding new and unusual role-playing challenges and opportunities, situations to thrust them in that fit into the context of the story and make the players go, I had no idea my character was going to go this way or be confronted with these things. And then what happens then is all of those experiences that I play in my campaign then translate into the work I do and how I perceive the D&D game and how I hope to create things for the D&D game that allow others to share that experience.
Excellent answer.
These are great questions and answers so far. The internet is blowing up, just so you know.
Yeah. fun time.
Trevor, you're probably not going to answer that one?
I guess I can say what I see these guys doing a lot too. It's I have to say what Chris and Mike have touched on it. They anything that could possibly influence the game, they will stop and think about it. Especially other games, like Mike was going on digital games, but like when the new Warhammer Fantasy RPG stuff came out, I went downstairs and I had a conversation with them because I liked what they were trying to do with the group. Like the things that they were trying to make happen with the group dynamic, and like here's some cool group benefits you got. So we were talking about like ways that we could just make up implementations for that. Like, well, we could make some weird group backgrounds or some weird group themes, but like have unique stuff. Like, you know, this guy's a surgeon, but he's a mercenary surgeon, and he works well with other mercenary types, and they do some weird stuff. But games in general, like anytime someone's doing really cool, something really awesome, I see these guys looking at it. It's like, well, what can D&D learn from that particular game? What can we apply? What's neat that way? I know that people make the WoW reference all the time, but it's just D&D fed lots of games. Those games are going to continue to feed D&D back as far as like what's cool and what we can take. So that's something I see us doing constantly.
Front row?
Yes, question about the design element. In older editions, races were differentiated by stat bonuses. Now in 4th edition, we have racial encounters and racial feats. Was the possibility ever thought of, instead of having stat bonuses for races, stat bonuses for classes, i.e., I'm a battle rage fighter, so I'm doing all this strength and endurance training, plus 2 strength, plus 2 con?
Yeah, it's tricky. I don't know if we talk about that specifically. And there's definitely, yeah, the races have moved to be a more active part of your character. I just don't know if we ever came up with that specifically, and can't think of any. I think the feeling was, it might still be, I don't know, if you're a dwarf, people expect dwarves to be tough, and you can reflect that through their power, but it also makes sense to reflect that through a stat mod. The way I kind of think of it is your race is sort of what you are, and your class is what you do, but I could easily see having modifiers sit in both. You know, if the race was pick one of two, and the class was, here's what you get.
I remember when we had this discussion back in the day when we were playtesting. We want a race to matter more. So we had the powers, we had the flavor, we had the skills, and we had the stats. Because we wanted to, like, when you made your race choice, you wanted to be more than just, you get this plus 2 to the stat. I remember that being a big part of the discussion, but I didn't even consider adding stats to a class. That could be pretty cool.
Next.
Input. Do you want me to ask one? This is your live blog.
Well, why don't you go ahead and grab the one from Marcel on my behalf?
Well, hang on. I've got to find it. I do have one while I'm looking for this other one. As I got this question from a couple of different people. Will we ever see a price drop in the current 4th edition core books? DMG 1, Player's Handbook.
That's not in our department. Yeah. We don't.
No, you ask us to predict the future as well. It is possible. We don't have any current plans to do so.
Yeah, those decisions are made a combination of our sales team and our brand team working with various other forces.
I think on the racy we would be consulted.
Yes.
One from the peanut gallery?
Sorry. I'm going to repeat the question real quick for the mic. The question was, do we know of any price drops coming for the core, Player's Handbook, DMG, and Monster Manual? I mean, the answer is, we don't know. That comes from, like Chris was saying, the brand team and the sales teams basically determining what we need to set those prices as, and they would let us know, basically. Yeah.
Well, they might ask us, our opinion, does it make sense?
And, yeah, it's would people still buy it, that kind of thing. But,
so a number of you are pulling things from the web. How many of you are doing that? Okay.
Yeah.
That's needed. Next. Another one from the web?
No, actually, the other one I got before my Twitter application told me I was Twittering too much.
tweeting too much. You don't
Twitter. Twittering. Twittering.
Oh, no, whoa. Whatever.
All right, another one from the web. Who's got one? Go.
This is, comes from Marcel. This is directed specifically at Trevor. How awesome is it working with brilliantly inspiring people like MudBunny74, WolfStar76, and Michael Robles?
It's incredibly awesome to have such dedicated fans in the community and employees who want to make D&D a better thing and want to make community a better thing. There, look, is that the program?
Wow, you said that with such...
But no,
I'm convinced.
But no, seriously, MudBunny aside, he's a jerk. The community I work with is an incredibly impassioned, incredibly learned community. So they definitely have a lot of good things to say a lot of the time. So it's fun.
I have a question from the internet. It's a great one. The prison system in Illinois recently banned Dungeons and Dragons because of the gang-related activity. How do you feel about creating a game that inspires gang activity?
I don't get your ridiculous loaded question, Mr. Matt.
It's 140 characters. I had to put it in two.
We expect questions of all kinds. This is a good one.
So we're making gangs.
I think the first thing that we would address is that we disagree with that assumption.
We disagree with the Illinois State Prison.
Yeah, I would disagree with that assumption.
I have heard in the past that from my experience in customer service, that some prison systems did not like D&D because it had dice, and dice were used to do other things. And that's
well, good thing you created the virtual table.
Yeah.
I think you have to explore why it inspires or so-called gang-related activity, because it might be in A plus B is not actually equaling C. It might be a coincidental rise related to something, a different aspect about the game.
I've read a whole bunch of reports about this and the actual news articles and some of the stuff that's come out of the trial. And honestly, we're not going to be able to comment a whole lot on this because basically it becomes a PR issue. But what it comes down to is the court made some statements based on what the correctional officers were saying. I can't say the correctional officers were wrong or they shouldn't be worried about how their inmates are going to act. But there's a lot of assumptions made about since D&D is a game where a group gathers and there is a dungeon master who kind of directs that group into playing, and they started linking that to certain types of gangs at games.
I should mention that it was probably a more tongue-in-cheek question.
Well, that's cool. No, but it's been asked. So we're good. So in the end, it's like they made their decision. I get where they were trying to make their decision from, but...
Yeah, I'd read something like that. Any activity that puts one person sort of in power over someone else in the prison.
That's really basically what it came down to.
Like banning all graphics on T-shirts in school.
Yeah. Right. I also have no idea how they're actually playing the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So without that information, I just... can't really speak intelligently about that situation, but not my call.
Next.
With there's only feats at every even level, and unfortunately there being so few, some believe that you have to choose nothing but combat feats. Was there ever a possibility of doing even the combat odd, the role-playing type feats or background type feats to kind of give you more character or more towards your skills?
Yeah, it's tricky because a lot of that comes down to what the group feels like doing. So it's a little hard, like, if you're playing in a campaign with just a lot of fighting, do you feel like, well, I'm being forced to choose a non-combat feat, and I just don't care, because that's just not how we play? And then vice versa, for the really role-playing heavy campaign, well, I'm being forced to choose a combat feat. And then it's kind of like, you know, with the powers and stuff, people are like, well, I'm choosing those attack powers, but that's not what I want the campaign to be about. So that's kind of just really hard to manage, because I think it comes down to managing the group and their expectations. And it's something with D&D, I think, has always had that issue of, well, how do you play the game? Like, it's D&D is very different from other games, that how you play is as varied as what kind of game you play, you know?
Yeah, quick, have you ever thought about using combat feats that have a little small skill bonus or small little role-playing type added to it?
We try in the essentials to add some more flavor to them, to give them a little more of a feel of what the feat represents. Yeah, I don't know if we've ever had that specific idea come up, though. Yeah, that's what we're thinking about.
Yeah, it's not something that I've usually championed, mostly because my philosophy is people will bring in as much role-playing as they want. It doesn't have to be attached to a mechanic in order for that to happen.
Okay. It's a lot of times when I have the discussions with people and they start talking about, I don't feel like 4th edition allows me to role-play. That's something we talked about. But after talking with them, they look at the rules, and the rules don't tell them how to roleplay. They're not giving them incentives to roleplay. And I agree with Chris, where it's like, I will set the rules up, we'll set our characters up, we'll set the game up, but if it's a roleplaying campaign, we discuss that. Like, we talk about that when we go into the campaign. So there's going to be lots of roleplaying. I expect you guys to be in character, you know, I'm going to help you flesh out your background, I'm going to make sure you guys have hooks, that kind of stuff. That's what encourages roleplay. I don't so much look forward to be in the rules elements of the game.
Yeah, I'm also as lazy as a pool of tar, generally speaking. So the feats that I really like are feats that I can write down on my character and never have to look at again. They sort of built into the kind of the mechanics of how the character work. They give me some flat bonus. It's already incorporated, and I never have to even worry about them. So, but that's just me.
Matt, you have a question over there too.
It's not my question, but on a personal level, what class do you? Gets you excited as a player, not as a designer or
Ranger. I don't like taking damage.
It's just like, I can't wait to play.
I love playing the Ranger because I don't like getting hit.
The Bow Ranger.
Bow Ranger.
Yeah, let's make that clear.
Yeah,
I like to play the DM, but I mean, I like being DM. I don't know what as far as a class. I just like to play the guy, like the troublemaker. So whatever I can get away. I like playing rogues because you can get out of trouble easier. But yeah, all things being equal, to like Dungeon Masters.
I study martial arts, so I get hit all the time in real life. So when I escape, I don't want to take any damage.
For me, I suppose it's the classes vary, but it's the charismatic ones that get to talk a lot. I have no clue why I would like the guys that get to talk a lot. But right now I'm really excited about the Hexblade. There's some stuff that's not out yet that I'm really excited about.
Trevor, what class do you like to play?
I just Hexblade. Hexblade and Paladin, I think, are the two that I'm enjoying the most right now.
All right, Mike, since you like to DM, what type of NPC do you like to role play?
I like to put the NPC where I just say his name, the player's all groan. Because they're angry or they're mad. I love the continuing menace. And the thing with it is I'm always fair. Like, if I'm a potentially recurring NPC or villain, I kind of give him his abilities to escape or whatever, and I don't screw with those. And I just let it happen, and because I think that the organic one is the one that's the most irritating. And it's fun. I had one campaign where there was this one bad guy who had this trick where he could make an illusory double of himself, like where he was standing, and then turn invisible and teleport. So he'd be standing there, then suddenly he's like, you know, that's an illusion, and he's standing somewhere else invisible. And I got the characters with it every single time. Because either he would do it, and then they would run up and attack the illusion, and it would turn into a cloud of poisonous smoke, or he wouldn't do it. He would just act like he was an illusion. And they would, oh, don't attack him, because he used his power. He'd turn and run away. God damn it. So I love tormenting my players with NPCs like that. But I'll try to play fair, right? If they go to the corner of the guy and take him out, that's fun. But
speaking from experience, I know Chris is kind of the same way. We've had these two people we were just talking about the other day in the IO Manager campaign on Wednesday, where try as we might, they have gotten away every time. And I don't think Chris is necessarily trying too hard to let them get away. It's just
circumstances.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sort of in the same vein as Mike. I like those villains that linger and confound the characters, particularly if it's the character's own actions that have sort of enabled that to happen.
Yeah.
I'm not the type of person who forces a villain to live because I like the villain too much. I don't get attached to them for that very reason. I like the villain NPC who the characters want to kill but can't.
Yeah, it's a fun one too. They need him for some reason, or
exactly
he's some important guy.
He's some important guy. He's just too politically well connected. If they killed him, the repercussions would just be too great in their mind.
Yeah,
where they have to make it, where they come to the decision when they do finally kill him, the decision comes with some consequences that they have elected to withstand.
Yeah, or he's useful. I had a 3-5
campaign.
Or
he's useful.
Yeah, I had a 3-5 campaign with I don't like it, personal thing. When players buying magic items all the time, just always irritates me. But the I had a campaign where the players wanted to buy all these magic items, and so I made up the weapons dealer in town, who was a complete jerk, completely shifty, completely untrustworthy, and they didn't realize it, but all the items he made, he basically put like arcane listening devices on. So you could do a ritual, and you could listen in, so when you're swinging around your +2 purple sword that you so proud you just bought, he knows exactly where you are and exactly who you've killed with that weapon and all this stuff. And they never figured that out. They just kept going back and buying stuff from him because they like buying magic items. So,
oh, I also like good NPCs who are party information sources, but they're often wrong.
Yeah, the nice, like the sort of the
they're not omnipotent.
The guy from the Prancing Pony kind of thing, where he's really nice, but he forgets that Gandalf gave him a message. Sort of thing.
Yeah.
I thought we had a question from Steve. But
no, I was just saying a follow up on Mike's. I love to assassinate his bad guys.
That's why in that game, yeah. I don't take notes because I never know when they're going to die.
A question from the internet. You made a lot of changes in the past few months. Online CB, Essentials DDI. What have been your surprises and disappointments?
Mm-hmm. Surprises. well, that's a good question. I don't know if anything is. As far as something we've changed, as far as the reaction that's been a surprise, or as far as I hope what we did has, what we've done hasn't been a surprise. That'd be a little, oh, yeah.
We put that in there.
Are they asking us what were surprises to us?
Yeah, to you guys.
Oh, okay.
I mean, that's
as a post release, kind of like. What,
yeah. Like, I think, like, oh, I didn't think that was going to be sellable, or oh, I didn't think people were going to play that class, or something like that. You know, just.
I've been pleasantly surprised by the reaction to Game World. I was worried that people would. See, you know, the cards just like,
yeah.
It's the magic RPG, so no one wants to
play. I was a little afraid too that people would take it as flippant, or they wouldn't know that it was intended to be a funny game.
Yeah,
and you know, Wizards of the Coast. I think the perception is we take our works very seriously a lot of the time, and clearly this is one instance where we didn't. I mean, we had Rob Schwalb write one of the expansions. Clearly, we weren't being, you know, serious.
I guess as far as disappointments go, I mean, Essentials has been really strange in that we tried so hard. I mean, I still get questions about it. It's just new options to the existing game. But I think it's definitely a lot of lessons for us to learn there and how we rolled that out and just the packaging and how it's presented.
Yeah. I think a lot of people just missed that it was really intended for kind of a different crowd of people who are just sort of getting into the game or looking for just a sort of more digestible way of getting their class information. It wasn't intended to replace necessarily something that they were already playing.
Yeah. I mean, I would have to echo both of those things. Yeah. Like, for Game World, when we first announced the cards last year, in the last year, beginning of this year, people were like, oh, cards, I don't know, blah, 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 Magic, the RPG. And I was like, no, guys, seriously, calm down, it's going to be cool.
On the other hand, they're being extremely well-reviewed, and that didn't surprise me, because they're really pretty. I mean, the DM kit has a lot of cool stuff in it.
The Essentials is, I'm in the same boat as far as the Essentials go. We knew what the risks were going in with people, with people's perceptions. We wanted to try to message it as much as we could. Like, this isn't, you know, this is the same game. We're adding some cool new options, and we're adding some different flavor for some classes to make it easier for a certain audience. But the responses that we got of how it changes the game, and how for some people they feel like it's ruined the game, and I'm like, but don't use those features that you don't like. And it's
right.
Like, well, if you didn't like the Paladin, but you didn't think the Paladin ruined the game, how is this any different? Just don't use the Paladin, just don't use whatever feature.
It speaks to the biggest difficulty I think D&D faces, traditionally faces, and still faces today, that, you know, I've been going through a lot of like old books and stuff, and it's been really interesting to me to look at. I was looking at the Combat and Tactics book for 2nd edition.
Oh,
and I was looking at the Player's Handbook for 2nd edition. Yeah, you say, oh god, but then I looked at the 3rd edition Player's Handbook and realized the 3rd edition combat system is basically the 2nd edition combat system with everything from Combat and Tactics added.
Added and then back over reversed.
Yeah, exactly. And like, and you can see what changed, but it's just sort of like, this is really interesting. This is a game that at each time you've gone from one edition to the next, all the optional rules, the prior edition, become core rules. And that's happened four times now. And you get the sense of, if you were to take D&D and look at it as like, well, let's imagine you're a D&D player who started playing in 1974, and you're still playing today, and it's a theoretical person, but whatever. It's like, as you played more and mastered more, the game just got more and more complex, until like the game of today is the game designed for someone who's been playing for however many years. And when you look at Essentials, where it's like, well, here's kind of this new gateway for new people, and, well, how do you do that without all the existing players just getting really confused? Because they're used to all the complexity being added at the top. And, well, now we're trying to add something at the bottom, and it just threw people for a loop. No one was really sure how to react to that, because that's never really been done before. You know, it's not really, since even when you had basic D&D back in the 80s, it wasn't compatible, it wasn't really the same, it wasn't the same game. And if you were a real D&D player, you didn't play basic D&D, you played AD&D. That was D&D. Now, I play basic D&D, a lot of it, but you'd see that attitude in, you know, the older kids at school, all you're playing, you know, it's not really D&D. And that's the game, I think, you know, it's interesting to see people still playing it and kind of appreciating it for what it was. But I think that's something that's just the biggest problem D&D has right now, is how do you manage that? How do you keep the established players happy while creating channels for new players to get in? You know, kind of like the interface issue. The Wii is, I mean, before the Wii came out, all the industry insiders in the video game industry, well, it's not going to go anywhere. This is dumb. Who wants to play tennis when they could play, you know, Gears of War 4, you know? And it turns out a lot of people want to play tennis on their Wii, because most people don't own a tennis court or are like me and are in bad shape and are much better at Wii tennis than at real tennis. So,
if the RPG industry did not exist, what profession would you have?
Wow. I have no idea.
Like, well, I guess if it ended today.
If it ended today.
Try to do.
I'd probably work for like some computer game company, or presumably that's where my ability is. I don't know. I don't really think of, it's sort of weird. I don't know, but like I kind of stumbled into this, and I started out thinking I'll do this because it's fun, and as soon as it's not fun, I'll stop doing it. But I've never really thought of, like, well, what would I do next? I think I just find what else is fun, and I do that for the rest of my life. So maybe like become a vet or something. I love animals, so maybe do something with them. Dog walker or something. aiming high as usual. Ivy League degree. Yeah.
Television producer.
That is not surprising, actually. Seeing how he sets up his adventures and how you think of things as episodic format, that is not surprising.
Actually, would you need like someone to play the wacky neighbor in your show?
I think I could. There wouldn't be a wacky neighbor in my show.
It'd be more believable. His show would be believable.
This one was a wacky neighbor.
Yes. Okay.
I could do that. I could play the wacky neighbor. I don't know what genre or show.
So if there hadn't been an RPG industry, I would have probably ended up doing some type of content editing for a magazine. If something disappeared now, I would be a community manager at a software company or a computer hardware type company.
There are other services such as Xbox Live that have a community member spotlight, and then also, I guess going to Chris, has there ever been a chance to spotlight someone's mission that's actually got through, that's not even well known, to kind of show this is how they did it? So I guess two questions for both of you.
When you're referring to a submission, you're referring to what specifically, like an article?
An adventure.
Oh, okay. There's sort of the de facto, hey, you got it published, ergo, you know, rock on. It's being seen by people, it's being showcased. That's one level of support. We periodically do contests and things like that where we try to trumpet that sort of thing. We do adventure design or character design. In fact, we just had one for the D&D movie where you had to submit your character, and if you won the contest, you would actually be brought to the movie set dressed up as that character and in a scene.
Did we specify, like, no cross-gender characters? Or?
We gave them a finite list of options. Okay. Yeah, for that reason. Mostly because I don't think they wanted a Warforged or anything like that running around.
Oh.
I think that we should be looking at more opportunities in the future to really sort of champion the creations of the people in the community. and I look forward to more of those discussions with Trevor and others.
Yeah, I think the virtual table has got to raise on my own.
I know the virtual table is a very interesting tool for that kind of thing.
Oh, okay, great one.
Steve Winter, who's what's his title now?
He's the editor in chief of the online magazine.
So editor in chief. So I know recently, in the last couple months, he reached out to one of the bloggers on our community site,
yes.
And went, because the blogger said, "Hey, I'm going to write, my next blog is going to be about this." Steve reached out and went, "You know what? I think it's a really cool idea. I like the stuff you've done. If you write that article and give it to me, I will pay you for it instead." So I know he reached out and did that, and it caused this awesome buzz. We recognized him. We tweeted it out. And then Steve and I had talks about doing that on a regular basis, how else we could highlight people in the community. So we're definitely interested in it. There's other stuff we can do on the community site to highlight specifically cool stuff, like maps, character and monster creation, all sorts of stuff, as well as getting them featured in the DDI content. So
my question more tease for like the gamer side, not necessarily designer, like spotlighting a person who games this. Is there profile on the kind of little interview things like Xbox Live does for their individual gamers?
Oh, we're looking at actually changing, like basically getting like player scorecard kind of things going on that highlight them as members and like what they're doing and what they're playing and that kind of stuff. We are looking at that.
Yeah.
Hopefully we're going to have some added features to the community to kind of highlight the stuff you're talking about.
I had kind of weird, I haven't talked to Trevor about this before, so I'm sure I'm going to irritate him by just putting this straight up.
No, that's fine.
But I was thinking the other day, like, you know, we have awards for the game industry, like if you make a good game, people give you an award.
Yeah.
And thinking like, that's nice, but like, why don't we give awards to people who play games, like who evangelize? Like that to me is like, it's a win for everybody. Like, you make a cool game, well, you played the game, you had fun, and you enjoyed it. Presumably, if I make that game, I got paid for it. Like, that's my reward, and your reward is playing and enjoying it.
Yeah,
but there are a lot of volunteer things people do that...
I'm looking at building I don't want to call it a reward system, but a recognition system for people when they do cool things and how they can reward each other, plus big how cool. We can reward them.
Big plaques.
Big plaque. Well, no, I mean, because...
Not so small, you know.
I'm not big, like, physical stuff isn't the way to go, man. Like,
why?
Mine's all digital stuff.
You mean like D&D Championship?
That's right. Current D&D Champion.
That would be Steve awesome from. If you guys did
yeah.
PA. Did they give you a belt or a trophy or anything?
I got a trophy. It's a big crystal thing, and I thought about coming and wearing it like bling.
You should have.
Awesome.
You should have.
Got a great question here. What is one product you would really like to see, but because of business realities, will never happen?
Ooh. That's awesome.
Ooh. That's a good question.
Wow.
Model my own 3D miniature.
Yeah. Oh, man, what would I do if I could do anything?
If you can do any product, but because of business realities, you know, will never happen.
Wow. Red Steel.
So that's the
Red Steel.
It's like, you ask me one question. Only one question? Yes, done. The thing is, the business realities, it's like, you know, it is so, my attitude is always like, well, there's no business barrier we can't overcome or figure out a way around. So I guess the thing just off the top of my hip.
Mike, they come to you and they say, Mike, I've got a $4 million budget. I want you to make something flippin' awesome that's been sitting in your noggin.
If I can make anything at all. And for D&D?
I know what it is.
What is it? Tell me what it is. Tell me what it is. What is it?
Greyhawk box.
No, see, I think bigger. I think bigger.
Greyhawk expanded universe / Warhammer,
exactly. All in one.
Yeah.
No, I don't want to do something really ambitious, because ambition is the thing that people get, like, you know, you start thinking how big something can be and they start getting nervous. I think I would take that money. No, I think I would do something with Greyhawk. I think I'd do some, like, crazy crowdsourced, like, ownable, like, Living Greyhawk kind of regional organized play, like... Everyone's character, regardless of how you're playing, is in the campaign. It's all going in at once, and like you register, and you're like, okay, you register as a DM, you get this little county, and it's yours, and here are the neighbors, and here are the rules to interact with the people, and it's all right there.
Nice.
And so
that's
what I do. That's exactly what I do.
I don't have $4 million.
So. What about you?
and that's more technically real. Technical
reality. You can't steal it. Before the ring.
Yeah.
I was having trouble distilling it down. One of them was actually sort of the ultimate Greyhawk Uber product, because that answers so many dreams. But then I sort of flipped and I said, no, it's been so long since I've actually run a Greyhawk game. I want the complete Iomandra product. My own campaign, so I don't have to keep track of everything the way I'm keeping track of it now. And then, no... I changed my mind to the Gamma World MMO.
Oh, nice. Yes.
Wow.
Awesome.
And I think that's where I'll stand.
As impossible.
Applications in between modules.
Yeah.
Oh, man, I don't know. This isn't impossible. So I don't think I can think of something that's impossible. But this is super far-reaching, and I definitely couldn't have it tomorrow. I want a site where DMs and writers can put up their adventures, their content, their module, and sell it, iTunes style. A site that also has the virtual table that has access to all the books, and you can pick and choose what you want. People can rate the content, they can rate the authors, so people can see what's floating to the top and buy what they want straight from the people that are making it.
That sounds doable. Get on it.
It's not impossible, and it's a future we could possibly have someday, even with what we're doing. But it's not something I could have tomorrow, and it's something that there's a lot of stuff involved. But that's what I want. I want players and DMs to be able to rate each other, to be able to create their own products, to be able to access the system so people can have all the stuff online, and then, like I said, rate each other, build their own products, and sell it to each other.
They could all have brain chips that tell them how close the nearest DM is to their present location.
Yes. That's the impossible thing.
Yeah.
I want a ping to be able to know where all the local players are.
Major dream surgery on every D&D player.
Many will volunteer.
A few new people join. You guys bring questions?
I can find some.
And while you do that, I'm sure we have others.
Yeah, exactly. Go back, Matt.
What games other than Dungeons & Dragons are you in love with?
BattleTech.
Yes!
We do
so
that.
Fast.
That's easy. Yeah. Played Divine Right last night. That was awesome. That was fun.
Was
well,
awesome.
Top
Secret SI.
Ooh.
Yeah, that was good.
So you're
just
talking
about the TSR one?
Yes.
Oh, so 40K, if I could have someone build a table and paint all the miniatures for me.
I was about to say, I have the table. I don't have the miniatures for
me. How much you paying me?
Yeah, Steven will do it.
Will you, like, accept
product
points from the way I give you? Like,
we'll give you some product.
I'll paint you an army if I can come out and fight you in a 5,000-point Imperial Guard.
You're going to pay me 5,000 points for Imperial Guard? No, it's funny, because I like 40K, but I paint miniatures, and I paint miniatures for D&D. And if I try to paint a unit, I can't get excited about it. I don't know what it is. It's just, I like painting individual guys. I think probably it's because I was a BattleTech player first, and you could take like an Orion, a mech, and you paint it. You're like, okay, this will be on the board for a while.
Right.
Like, it's like, you know, 75-ton machine. It can take a lot of hits. But you paint, like, you spend 4 hours painting a space marine, and like one die roll and he's dead. It's like,
yeah.
A little sad. Like, what's with work in me? You're dead.
I'd have to say Gamma World, Dominion...
Wait, just a Game World, like a Game World version of Dominion?
No, Game World, I wouldn't call it exactly D&D, but I'm in love with Game World. I'm in love with Dominion, and when Diablo 3 comes out, I'm going to spend all my time playing Diablo 3. So.
Mm-hmm. Mass Effect, that's a cool game.
Mass Effect's an amazing game.
Question in the back. Go to the back.
Justin, you can
just
be next after
that one. Question.
Make sure you speak up.
Let's enjoy a question. Ask me again in a minute.
Sure.
The lady...
That's all right.
Gentlemen?
Dustin, you got one. I know you got one. It's funny, but you got one.
From Twitter, what is Greg Bilsland really like?
So put that in context. There's a whole bunch of Greg Bilsland rumors.
He's everything you've heard and more.
Yeah.
And then some.
I don't think we can add anything to that.
No.
Highly talented.
He taught Chuck Norris everything he knows.
Ooh.
Are you ever afraid of D&D maybe becoming... mainstream, where it doesn't even have its own little niche anymore? Is that never even a possibility?
Oh, it's like the old, you know, the band I like, people, other people like.
Right. Yeah, yeah. It's like, that's my, I found them, and they're supposed to be mine.
It's not cool anymore.
Right.
I think
we were cool.
Yeah.
Apparently we create games. So. I think the really issue is just, you know, D&D is its own little subculture, and I think if you change D&D to get more people to like it but then lost that subculture, I think you'd have lost something fundamental to D&D. And really, is it like at that point are you selling D&D to anybody or just selling generic fantasy? So much of D&D is the experience of being the DM and being the player and owning that stuff and making stuff that I think that, like the D&D cartoon, it wasn't D&D, right? I mean, it was neat to see those characters, but I watched it as a kid. I never... Like, it wasn't D&D to me. Like, I played D&D. I was, like, 8 or 9. But I knew, like, when you play D&D, you're not kids who are in a fantasy world with... They got magic items. They haven't even gone on an adventure yet. And what the heck, right? And this kid's playing a barbarian. I mean, barbarian is one of the most broken classes, and a cavalry. What the hell? You know, it's like this unearthed arcana using party with a bunch of magic items at first level. These kids are all cheesy and lame. Worst D&D campaign ever. And the dungeon master is always showing up and bailing them out. I mean, how many advantages do I have to give you before you can take care of yourself, right?
That sounds like the campaigns I ran when I was like 13. That's pretty typical.
A cavalier or a sword, it wouldn't be such a, you know.
Well, you should just go get one. They have, well, they just go roll somebody. They fought orcs just to kill somebody.
They can never kill anybody, though.
Yeah, and that was the other problem. Like, come on, you gotta, you know.
I think I'll let Chris answer too, but I think it's...
I don't remember the question.
At its core, D&D will always be this tabletop, you know, role-playing game experience that you were talking about with your DMs and your players. Even as we expand into video games and other things, it's always going to be at its core. So while it expands and while we get, you know, new players that wouldn't necessarily play that tabletop game, I don't think we'll ever lose that. I don't think we can. I don't think anybody who's doing this wants to lose that.
No, because without it, then you don't have D&D, because D&D is people who play it.
Yeah.
And if you don't have people who play it, no one's playing D&D, then what do you have? You have nothing, right? It's just...
Right.
It's just like you could call it whatever you wanted to. It's just kind of an empty IP that... The entire point is saying you're slapping D&D on something. Saying, hey, let's make a D&D video game. Let's play Forgotten Realms. Use Drist. If no one's playing D&D, then who is that aimed at? Right? It's like, it's just... What is it, right? It's not a brand that has any, or, you know, whatever. It doesn't mean anything to anyone anymore.
And to counter that, if we wake up one day and be like, man, we are too popular, that is a great... That'll be a great problem to try to figure out how to fix.
I think it is sad that there are people in the world who don't know what role-playing, the experience of role-playing, can do for them. For their lives, for their spouses, for their jobs, for any of their relationships, and for themselves. And I feel for them, and I will try to reach out to them in the best way I can, but I'm the senior producer for the D&D RPG, and so I want to make that experience true.
I just want to follow on that, Chris. That was a great point, because when I was deployed to Iraq, we played Dungeons & Dragons to forget about everything else.
Yeah.
And put us into a zone.
Yeah.
Only D&D could have done for us, so thank you for that. But my question, on a lighter note, what is your favorite rock band of all time?
Led Zeppelin.
Ooh, nice and quick.
I can't answer that quick.
I don't think I can answer that quick.
Oh, really?
You got time.
Steven looks like you just looked disgusted.
You look disgusted.
The Beatles.
Who?
The Beatles.
Nice.
That's a good answer.
Led Zeppelin's probably my pick, too. I mean, I've been listening to a lot of music, at least. I think they're a great modern rock band. I don't know that I'd say they're my favorite, so I'd have to say Led Zeppelin still.
Okay.
Sorry.
On a lighter note, have you guys ever tried LARPing or ever thought about trying LARPing?
I LARPed once. And I got in a car with some friends, and they were really into it. Piled in this car, drove 3 hours to northern New Hampshire, unloaded the car with all the camping gear, piled all on a boat. We then rowed the boat for like 30 minutes to an island on which there was a cabin that we were going to LARP at with other people that we had to send the boat back for. We get all in the costume, I'm given my character, like we get there, like we'd have to leave like at 6 in the morning, and it's like 5 o'clock at that evening, we're finally ready to go. We're all gathered in the cabin. All in character now. There's a knock at the door. I open the door. My friend Jeff is there. My friend Jeff screams and stabs me. My character's dead. I've never LARPed since then. I refuse to.
Wow.
You fell for the old scream.
No, he was surprised for some reason. He was surprised when he knocked on the door. I opened it up, and there was someone there. Like, Jeff was kind of a spaz and just freaked out that I was there and in character or something, and he just attacked me for no reason. And yeah, so I don't LARP anymore because of that.
I have never LARPed and will probably never do so.
Why?
That's a question rooted in some psychological issues that I'd rather not go into.
I am, I do LARP. I part of a LARP called Shadow Court that gets together every couple months for 3 days out of the month, and we go. It's a very immersive LARP where you're in game the entire time. And I was put off by it at first because it was pushing me way outside my comfort zone. But the experience was really awesome. So, I go back every couple months.
Yeah, it's like I watched the documentary Darkon. Have you guys seen that?
Yes.
And I realized, like, oh, this looks really cool. These guys are scheming, like, these plots. And I realized, no, I'd be like that random guy over there who, like, accidentally tripped and everyone's hitting over the head with a boffer sword. Like, that would be me.
See, like, boppers are like other people's clowns to me. I can't, like... Some people get freaked out by clowns.
Yeah.
Boppers do it for me.
I am one of the people that gets freaked out by clowns.
Question?
We can't talk the LARP question.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah,
that's what we can ask.
I'm in a dark place, so, you know, another person help me out a bit.
Yeah, ask like, what's your favorite flower? Yeah. It's
the kind I can cook with.
I know that other podcasts do this of actual play. Have you ever thought of maybe doing a actual play of, like, the Wizards of the Coast employees playing? Like, I know you play games throughout.
It has been often talked about that I should put a microphone in my Wednesday night group, but wow, there wouldn't be much left of that podcast once the editors were done with it.
We'd have to make it clear that... So, you guys have seen the commercials for Your Highness, some of you, right?
Yeah.
So, we saw that preview, and all of us were like, that's like the Wednesday group! That's pretty much us around the table Wednesday night. So it would be difficult for us to... But I hear the Monday night game is much more serious.
Well, yes and no. It's a little less crude, but... You know, equally fun. I think it's actually a worthwhile experiment because I think people underestimate that how entertaining it can be as a spectator event.
Yeah, I think what we thought about too is having games as like instructional kind of things. Like, you know, here's a skill challenge and we'll run it for you and just show you the video with the audio. And the thing is, it's just been a little. We tried that earlier. I think with 4th edition, we had like a preview video of people playing, and it's just a little hard to get that right.
It's actually one of those things I've brought up several times about how we use the VT, and it's starting to get some traction of, let's just get a whole bunch of people who want to talk about DMing an encounter, like have Chris in there, and Chris sets up the map for an encounter, and then everybody talks about the different things they could do to make it an awesome experience for the players, and stuff like that. So it's, we've been talking about that, and possibly podcasting that, or having people sit in and watch that kind of thing. So we're definitely interested. I just think sometimes we listen to what we say at our games, and we're like, maybe we can't legally... put this up on the website.
Oh, sorry.
I got one.
You, sir.
Is there any campaign settings that you would ideally that you would like to be able to do, but probably wouldn't be commercially viable?
It's not commercially viable. It's
Red Steel.
Yeah, Red Steel. I love the turtle.
Somebody really wants to do Red Steel.
I don't know. The commercial, that's kind of the tricky thing is I don't know, like, I want to be Greyhawk, but I think that would be commercially viable, so it doesn't really fall in that category.
Spelljammer?
I think
we
could
do
Spelljammer with the
Astro
Seabook we put out, honestly.
Spelljammer. I ran a Spelljammer campaign for 5 years. No, Spelljammer is near and dear to my heart, but it's so weird and wacky. I don't think it would have broad appeal.
I think you guys have taken the cool elements of Spelljammer and put them in like the Astral Sea book and the books that we've come out with. Where I'm like, look, this is basically a Spelljammer vessel. Yes, and Chris has them all over his campaign setting.
Yeah, I was never a big setting guy, so I was never really like all those settings, especially in Second Edition.
Yeah.
TSR did. I didn't really get too much into them. I always like Greyhawk. So
yeah. I like Planescape for the way it felt and all the the politics and the philosophy that was embedded in it. I know that some people were a little daunted by the cant and all of that, but it was inspiring. And we absorbed a lot of that into sort of the 4th edition cosmology to the extent that we could.
I was so excited to see Sigil in the Plains book that we did. I was like, holy crap, this is awesome. Because I was...
It's pronounced Sigil.
Sigil, I know, I'm sorry. It's pronounced Sigil. But, like, for me, Planescape was Torment. Like, Planescape Torment, like, that defined Planescape for me. So I was like, I just wanted to play that over and over and over and over again. Like, it get, like, all those characters, all those NPCs, all that kind of stuff. So.
There's a Dying Earth role-playing game that came out maybe about 10 years ago now. And what I liked about it was the players were actively encouraged to kind of screw each other over. And there's a mechanic for you could talk people into doing things, and if you succeeded, they had to do it because you're just so well-spoken and persuasive. They couldn't help but follow your brilliant suggestions. And I love to do a game like that, but I realize for like 99% of people who play RPGs, it's all about like personal empowerment, and they would not want a game where someone tells them like, "Hey, you know, taste this potion," and they have to, right? So I can understand why that's probably not personally viable. But games like that, I think, are hilariously fun because it so cuts to the point of the players, you know, causing havoc, not only with the NPCs, but amongst each other. So,
speaking of that, Ravenloft, like, Ravenloft was all about playing bad characters most of the time when we were playing it. The Sword and Sorcery take on it, where they had all this stuff fleshed out. But now that we've got Shadowfell stuff, and that we've got things going on, it's like, I feel like I can create most of that without having his own campaign setting.
My players never wanted to be in the Ravenloft campaign setting.
It's scary!
I put them in, and they could not wait until they were out of it.
Chris is a scary DM. I just want to point this out. If he gets in his mind that he's going to run you through a horrific experience, I'm not going to say you'll be scarred, but you will want to get out of whatever thing he has put you in.
Wait, is that in the game or out of the game?
In the game. In the game. The rest of my players, like the fellow players, are the ones that scar you. Permanently.
Carnival of Clowns for Trevor Kidd.
I'll just get up and leave.
If your spirit had to be in, of your character had to be eternally tormented, would you prefer Thar's Dune or Cthulhu?
My character. Probably Cthulhu. Because he just has a, I don't know, hard to pronounce name. That's my arbitrary decision. Well, I mean, you're pretty, like, said I'm screwed, so it's like, do you want to be, like, do you want to fall off a 100-story building or a 105-story building? Well, I mean, which one has the better view?
You know? Yeah. Maybe we can trade off so the experience at least changes a little bit.
What's your favorite, Thar's Dune or Cthulhu?
I think, like, Cthulhu, because, I mean, I have a plush Cthulhu. I don't have a plush The Raised Dead or what is it?
He did get the merchandise.
Yeah, he's got a great agent.
I think Cthulhu is a little more relatable and cuddly than Thar's Dune. Thar's Dune's sort of distant. You're not really sure what he is. He hasn't got a face.
Yeah, I think his kind of entire shtick is you're not ever supposed to actually see him, or there's just hints of him here and there. Like the old Forgotten Temple Thrisden module is kind of cool.
It's like, ooh, Thrisden's going to get me. He's never going to show up. You say that, you say Cthulhu's name, next thing you know, you're flattened by a 4,000-pound octopus guy. It's just,
I agree with all of that.
I have one actually from Twitter. Just copy paste it again here. Beyond Legion of Gold and the novels, are there any plans for future Gamma World support or other genres based on 4E?
No plans right now.
Nope.
So, but you never know what we'll do. So
we will surprise you. No.
Yeah, to an extent.
Yeah. Has there ever been any thought into doing modules or adventures based off the novels that you publish?
We actually have some tie-ins with Neverwinter, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I think there's some tie-ins. It's something we're doing with the Neverwinter. There's the computer game coming out, and there's also a R.A. Salvatore novel coming out. And I know that the background of the D&D source book draws in part on that novel. Mm-hmm. Like, they're all assumed it's all kind of coordinated with the timeline. The it's always a little tricky when you have an adventure directly based on a novel. Like, look back at Dragonlance, there's, people, obviously there's a hit, it's time, but I don't know if the modules, people bought those to read them about the world or to actually play them.
No.
There's always a sense of, well, if I read the novel, I'd know how the adventure goes, so how do I want to, just managing that.
Yeah.
So,
how literal the translation is, that's a part of the question, too. Like, if it literally was you have to play Dredst and Brunor and those other classes, then it would feel more like the Dragonlance saga. I'm not sure how people would respond to that.
But I think something in a board game where you don't have quite as much of a commitment to the character, I think that's pretty fertile ground where you can say, hey, let's refight the War of the Lance or something like that.
Yeah.
And everyone gets the story. In RPG, I think people just kind of like, they like their characters to be kind of like, not necessarily the most important people in the world, but kind of the stars of the story. And if someone else shows up and it's
you
like,
can do
like
plastic figures of Gold Moon and Riverwind, and you can have them make out on the game board, and
but
then they go away.
But I think in an RPG, like, I know when I was a kid, especially, well, maybe it's still this today, if I met some important character from the novel, I'd maybe try to kill them just to screw with the world, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah. That's what the Wednesday group would do if Dritch showed up.
Yeah, they tried to beat him up.
Well, first of all, we have a bad experience with Drow right now, so.
Yes.
Everyone has brought it to the Drow, especially Justin.
Yesterday, in the product spotlight, the conquest of Nerath was touched upon. And it seems like an interesting new direction maybe Wizards hasn't really gone before. Is there anything more that you can tell us about that at this time when that's going yesterday?
The details of the game, I don't know how much we want to go into, but it does kind of set a stage for when you think of what D&D is and how you can express it. What are the different elements of D&D and what's the best way to express them? And I think there's a lot of different ways we can express those. And I think that when you kind of look at that game, that ties into that. Like, fantasy warfare has always been a part of D&D. We always get people, hey, don't we, we did a warfare book for 3.5. There was the battle system, miniatures rules. So I think this is just another way we can express that, you know, in the world of D&D with a very D&D flavor to it that speaks to D&D fans. And so I think we're definitely going to look at how that goes, and we're, you know, how
it's very much an experiment and a test for us. We have absolutely no idea how people will respond to this kind of flavor of D&D, the mass combat, army against army type thing. But we'll see.
Yeah.
It's two different audiences, I think, maybe. But
yeah, could
it be made part of a campaign, just as instead of a single squad battle? Maybe it's
if the campaign is built to accommodate it, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't see how it couldn't.
This is a very strategic level game. So you're like, it's a little, the actual army's fighting is a little more abstract, but you could definitely use the map for a campaign setting like we've got.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's true.
Stuff.
Easily.
We actually went in for every section of the map. We wrote up flavor for it. I don't know if any of that shows up in the game, but we try to get a sense of what are each of these regions like, each of these kingdoms and whatnot.
Yeah.
I'm coming in late, so if this already got asked, sorry. Question from Twitter is, wants to know if we'll see anything else in hardback or if everything's going to be soft cover like the Essentials from now on.
I know. We've got Heroes of Shadows hardback, the Neverwinter campaign settings hardback, the Heroes of the Feywilds hardback. I might be forgetting one, and I know we're doing hardcover back books. Those are still in play. We're still doing those.
Yeah, and just to repeat the question, are we planning on doing any more hardcover books? So
the answer is yes.
I had one more in regards to the board game. Will we see any sort of mass combat rules in a separate product, or will it be in the board game maybe for use with 40 where people want to run massive kind of army versus army games in their campaign?
I think we would look at that and try to figure out what's the best way to make that happen. And that's kind of what would guide that decision of how we wanted to present it. So,
I got a question for Twitter. Do you eventually plan to phase out hardcover books?
I hope not, because we're doing 3 more this year, and we're still doing them. So no, there's no. I think the thing is, people look at, well, you're not doing as many books, and it's just, well, that's all it is. We're just not doing as many books. We only have finite resources to go around. So if we do something like the Conquest of Narath, we need a board game. We couldn't definitely not do, like, say, 3 hardcover books a month, and board games, and things like fortune cards, and the organized play programs, and maintain quality. We just can't do that. So we only have so many resources around, and when we look, you know, it's kind of like Chris talked about yesterday. If you have, like, Arcane Power 3 comes out, and people only use some small part of it, well, is that really serving? Are we doing this because that's what we've always done, or are we doing this because this makes sense and it's going to meet a demand? And I think when we look at these products, it's like, well, we think these books are going to be great, but we don't want to be in a position of saying, well, we have to release 10 books, and, you know, we don't have confidence that anything more than the first 4 are going to be what people are interested in. But it has, like I said, when you talk about the mass combat thing, we have concepts for stuff. We'll deliver it in the way we think is the best fit for the product and the best fit for the audience. We're not going to say, well,
if, you know, we think the audience even wants it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But if, you know, like the mass combat thing, if we go and go, well, we could do just a hardcover book if we're going to do something like that. We could do a box set. What's the best product? What's the product when people go into the store and look at the shelf, hey, I want that. You know, that's really what we're fishing for in that kind of, especially format.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, is just people look at it and go, that looks really neat. Well, they want to pull it off the shelf and take a look at it and hopefully leave the store with it. After paying for it, of course. Mm. But, you know, we don't want to just say, well, this is how we've done it. I mean, I think it's just when you look around, you know, society-wise, Western world, whatever, that's just happening in every area. So how do you deliver stuff, right?
Right.
DVDs, right? I mean, people still buy DVDs, but, well, then now there's Netflix, you know, Blockbuster going out of business, all this stuff. There's just, as things go digital, I think people are just consuming media differently. And even in the game store. I mean, if you go to a game store, 10 years ago, you go to a game store, there's a big shelf of RPGs. There's all these books face out on those shelves, and there's a good size section there. You know, in 10 years before that, you would have had that. And then, you know, the TCG showed up, but they were kind of like at the front by the register in their own little space. You go to a game store now, and it's a big display of, like, Games Workshop miniatures, and Malifaux, and War Machine, and there's a huge wall of board games with a lot of colorful art, and a big box. I mean, there's got a lot of... basically, Space Hulk, when I was a kid in high school, Space Hulk was the most awesome game because it was, like, you know, $80 and had all these miniatures and all these parts, and it was the only game like that. And now if I go to Uncle's Games down the street from where I live, there are like 20 Space Hulks. But there were 20 different games like that. I mean, just look at the component list and you look. Everyone's doing games like that now. So it's just, even in the game store, how people are consuming games is changing. You know, and obviously now that's, if you like books, I'm not going to, well, nobody wants books. I mean, that's not what we're saying. What we're saying is things are changing and we have to adapt to it. But we also, you know, it's not like we're just no books ever again. It's just saying, let's make sure that there's an audience out there, or even the audience of gamers, we're listening and watching what they're doing and delivering the appropriate, you know, the right content in the right format.
Does that mean you're going to make a space hall for wizards?
Actually, you could say that the Castle Overgrowth is a little bit, was inspired in part by space hall. Yeah. So,
speaking about digital books, what's the plan for us to get digital versions of future D&D releases?
So that falls under the digital stuff, which we don't sort of drive, but they're definitely... It's definitely a known issue.
It's something we're looking into. I mean, I can't talk about the options that we're experimenting with right now, but we are definitely concerned with it. We know the people are definitely concerned with it, and we want to get you guys digital offerings.
I would say, I don't mean to be a jerk, but you guys know better, right? Haven't you been doing that for a couple of years now? How long does this take?
We publish print products, and anything digital is not under our control. We're doing ebooks for the novels.
Okay. I think part of what people on the outside should realize too is that Wizards of the Coast, just in terms of its procedures and personnel, have changed over the course of time, and as new people leave and old people go, we often revisit where we are and what we want to do, and that's just part of the nature of being a very large company with a lot of fingers and a lot of pies and a lot of relationships with other companies in other realms who are working with us and giving us their opinion on how we should proceed. We have a very good relationship with Random House. We have a relationship with our core hobby distributors. We have relationships with digital companies on the outside and Atari. We have all kinds of relationships. So our plans often takes us a fair amount of time to move in a direction, and even when we do, sometimes we veer off because of something that we hadn't anticipated or something that's changed in the marketplace, in the economy, and that is, while there are advantages to having all of this contact and all of these relationships and all of these opportunities as being a big corporation, certain disadvantages also impact us, and one of them is, in things like this, we tend not to be as agile as we want to be.
Yeah, question. What is your guys' favorite weenie monster / minion?
Like, specifically named one, or just a kind of
creature? It could be just one you love, you know... I love my gingerbread cookies.
I like kobolds. To what?
The minion rust monsters.
Oh. Now I like kobolds, and especially like when they do annoying things, like the character gets knocked out, the kobold minion picks up the character's sword and runs away with it. That's a
good answer. I'm not sure I have a better answer than that.
Yeah, you just got finished playing kobolds today, so
yeah,
you might be kind of tainted.
I like all minions, and as Trevor knows, I have no qualms about the numbers of minions I throw into a game.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Yeah. It is fairly common. If I throw a minion on the table, he's usually got 100 friends with him, or, you know, at least 50 or 30. The rules for minions, as far as I'm concerned, I just throw them right out the window and say, 30 minions, not a problem. Characters can always run away.
I think the coolest minions I've seen are like they were dragons. They were basically little dragons, and they were minions.
Yeah,
the freaks right, these people write the heck out.
At the epic tier, when I start throwing down like mind flayer minions and giant minions, you guys are like,
yeah.
Oh
This may be asking earlier podcast recordings, but what do you do outside of D&D? What are your recreations besides D&D? And also feel free to give yourself a plug for your Twitter so people can follow you to find out what you do besides D&D.
My life is pretty much consumed by home improvement projects and my dogs and my wife, and my wife's home improvement projects, which vastly outnumber mine in both raw numbers and complexity. I think my Twitter is Mike Merles with no space in between Mike and Merles. So, yeah.
My time is occupied. Again, I have a three-legged dog that I spend a great deal of time with, but I also do a lot of writing on the side. I do extensive planning for my campaigns, both present and future. And I do martial arts.
A lot of my free time. Well, I'm in two D&D games and then a changeling game every week. So I have that sets up a lot of time. And then the rest of my free time, I am generally playing video games and or doing chores around the house. But video games lately have Assassin's Creed Brotherhood. I just finished up. I'm going back to Fallout Vegas to finish that one up. And then I spend a lot of time visiting my wife because she's in Des Moines right now, Des Moines, Iowa. So my Twitter is Trevor_Watsy. So, and I do LARP every 2 months. There you go. But yeah, I talk about D&D a lot, so that's pretty much what I talk about on that Twitter.
Newbie DM wants to know if you guys have any plans on looking at the issue of combat length or alternative quick skirmish rules.
So I was going to repeat that one for the mic. So do we have any plans on dealing with combat length or skirmish rules?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's something which we've actually internally talked about a little bit. And I don't want to, the exact format, but that's something maybe for an Unearthed Arcana style article or just other uses for skill challenge. It's definitely something like I think someone asked me was my biggest issue with 4th. It's combat length. It's just I wish combats could be faster. You could choose to dial it down and still keep it interesting.
We're actually experimenting with some things that are coming from the community about that, about people and their experiences. For instance, Steve Winter cued me into a blog that was basically a fellow whose name or handle escapes me right now, who had basically experimented with the idea of halving all of the characters' hit points and halving all of the monsters' hit points. And he was saying that this had done wonders for his game. And so I've been playing with that a little bit on and off and other things like that just to sort of see, how cool these ideas are that the community is coming up with, and actually some of them are interesting solutions.
Yeah, Greg Bilsland is running a game, a Dark Sun game, where we've changed totally how healing surges work or how they don't work necessarily. Like, we don't have them except for one, which we can use for our second wind. So it's interesting, and he's also increased played around with the amount of damage that monsters are doing to try to see how we change up combat. So I know that everybody's looking at that.
We experiment with house rules and alternate rules all the time because we're always sort of thinking about the game and sort of thinking about thought experiments, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Anyone else?
How do you feel about, D&D started back in the 70s, and it sort of seems like the player base is sort of slowly like growing older with getting new. Do you ever, what's your views on, I guess, people retiring, still playing D&D? people still playing D&D even as they retire from jobs and as they keep getting older. Is that ever?
Oh, yeah, no, it's funny. You think of demographics are like the big thing with, no one really thinks about this, but they're like, I think within some short time period, our population is going to start dropping. I mean, the only thing that keeps it up is immigration. There are fewer kids today than there were back than when we were kids, and a lot fewer than the 50s, 60s, 70s. And I think when you look at games, I mean, that's the big change has been, since the 80s, kids have played video games and games in general forever. But what's different now is culturally, it's okay for a 35-year-old guy to play a game. That back, when my dad was 35, he was busy working in a factory and he didn't have time to play games, right? Games for him was playing softball with the next Columbus team he was on. And now it's like everyone with a smartphone probably plays games on it. Everyone with a computer probably at least plays solitaire on it. That's just something that is just the entire culture, games permeated everything. And I think that's something that's only going to get, you're only going to see that even increase because the kids growing up today are surrounded by games, and they're sitting up and just getting older and older and older as far as people playing games. So I think it's kind of like everyone when they talk about games, they really aim at the teenagers. But I think someday, probably within our lifetimes, there's going to be a point where, teenagers are, and the cynical side of me thinks people aim at teenagers because teenagers aren't smart enough to know that ads are, not, they don't have your best interest in mind. But I think that we're going to hit a tipping point where people realize, teenagers, there aren't enough of them to really for us to make them our only target audience, and that things are going to shift to older generations, just demographics-wise.
I think the music industry is discovering that, too. A lot of the same things, reflections of the same things happening.
Yeah.
Right?
From Twitter via Wolf Samurai. So when are the Acquisitions Inc. crew going to reunite with Rad Longhammer and Hellbeast for more adventures?
Oh, Rad Longhammer. That is a fine, fine question. There is every intention on the parts of the DM and the players to get back together to resume the adventures of Acquisitions Incorporated. It's all a great matter of scheduling. And scheduling to get all five people into a room together is difficult. Because Will is very busy. The guys at Penny Arcade are very busy. But we'd at the very least like to do it once a year.
I'd like to point out that, I mean, Scott is apparently not busy at all. He's just sitting around. Doing like, oh, man. Sure wish I could play some D&D.
Yeah. He's drawing Ben Rin cartoons every night. Reliving the adventures. Yeah, no. So as soon as we're able to schedule something, we will. I've already sort of settled on, in my mind, where I think we could go. With that, and the continuing adventures must be told. So, we'll keep you posted, definitely.
This is a personal one. I've got a 4-year-old son and a 2-year-old daughter at home, and they are obsessed with my minis and my dice and my battle mats and the demographic that you guys were just talking about. Do you have any more plans to do any, like, I know there was the Wizard's License on the How to Trap a Vampire Catches, the kids' book. I got that for my son, and he's really into it. I just wondered if maybe there's any thoughts at aiming kind of like a more adolescent version of a kind of dumbed-down D&D system for younger kids to get them into it, because, I mean, if we don't get young kids into it, it's going to die with us, you know?
Oh, yeah, no, that's something we had the Heirs of Hesiod download on our website, which would be really popular. We had a lot of downloads on it. And that's really, it's like a D&D, a role-playing game aimed at younger kids. And we've definitely thought about that. I mean, right now, obviously, there's nothing on the schedule specific to it. But when we think of the big picture for D&D, we definitely think of products aimed at different age groups. Kind of goes back to what I was talking before about how D&D, you know, the role-playing game especially, it's just kind of gotten more complicated over the years as the players have gotten a little bit older and really relying on that social network of people to teach other people how to play it. You know, I think there's definitely a big space for that kind of product. It's really just about getting it right, you know, saying, well, you know, what is really the appeal to it, and how do you get across what's appealing about the role-playing game to people who haven't played before, to younger kids, teens, and stuff like that. So.
I don't
know. Before, yeah.
Do you guys have any plans on exploring options for cross and cross-classing, multi-classing, in 4th edition, more similar to 3rd edition, because
yes,
people hate the hybrid.
No, I can say yes.
Yeah, it's something that I know I've playtested some of this. I'm really excited about some of this.
Yeah, it's definitely something which we are working on and thinking about and testing.
Mm-hmm. That was an easy one. Anybody else?
Somebody wants to know if Nentir Vale was a home campaign or if you guys made it just for 4E.
It was made for 4E.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any plans to release any books about the Feywild, like you're doing about the Shadowfell?
We actually have Heroes of the Feywild coming out in November. So that'll have a lot of background information on the Feywild and for playing characters from the Feywild and different Feywild-inspired character options.
Are we doing anything, because it's something that I don't know, because I remember we talked about it, are we doing anything like a Feywild book like we did the Shadowfell book? Or is it always going to be a
It's not on the schedule. If anything like that's not on the schedule, we'll probably look at, as far as, generally most books we'll publish will probably be more player focused, box sets more DM focused, but there's always gotcha. Setbacks there. So think of the box set, it just takes more resources, so it's harder for us to do a lot in 1 year. So
I know another PC game is such one big component that I enjoy is the actual visualization of creating my character, like nose, mouth, or anything going on as far as website tools or anything to help create a visual look of your character and make it unique.
I don't think we have anything in store right now.
We're not working on anything like that right now. No.
Yeah.
We're focusing on the
more
well, the adventure, the adventure yeah. tools, the virtual table. Once we get that all fleshed out and where we'd like it, we will have an idea of what we're working on next.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that seems like, you know, icing. Let's get the cake right.
Yeah, exactly.
And I know that, like, if you go way back in the day, that our player plans were, you know, table, visualizer, character builder, those kinds of things. The visualizer at this point, we're not doing any work on a visualizer yet.
I guess give a plug, like Neverwinter Nights too. I enjoyed how you was able to change all your features.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
And that's
as we've talked about earlier, we expand out, we're doing more with these video game realms, it becomes much more likely that we'll work with one of those companies to take something that they've done like in that aspect and be like, look, let's just kind of work with them to see how we can possibly take some of that and put it to our
side. Like, for instance, I'm not giving much away when I say that Cryptic does pretty good engines for their character customization stuff, and they're working on a game for us now, and the stuff they're doing is amazing. It would seem like a natural for us to leverage some of their tech and skill.
That's what I'm hoping.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
Okay, we got
another one. Do you guys plan on keeping up with the one campaign setting a year model?
So do we plan on keeping up with one campaign setting model? I just want to repeat it, make sure. Make sure the microphone hears it.
I obviously can't comment on next time anything beyond what we presented, but we're treating Neverwinter as this year's campaign setting release. And so far it seems to work pretty well. The campaign settings don't seem to be colliding with each other. It seems to be each one gets the attention, you know, the game day and stuff that it needs, and we kind of roll on to the next one. So
yeah. The follow-up of that, I just want to reiterate something that we talked about in the product spotlight. We're really paying attention. We're going to start really paying attention to responses that we're getting, engaging our community in more conversations about what they want to see, and that will hopefully give us a driver to tell you what we're coming out with each year.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons that we're not going to be like, yes, we're going to do this every year, because if you guys don't want a campaign setting, we don't want to give you one.
Yeah. It's kind of the same before. We don't want to get locked into plans that end up not making sense, you know? So if it stops making sense, we'll stop doing it.
One of the philosophies for 4th edition was always bonuses. Bonus to stat, bonus. I just now noticed with the preview for Heroes of Shadow that the Shade has a negative to surges.
Yep.
So is this a new trend that we've possibly seen?
No, that's really just the flavor of that race. Because if I remember right, the Shade is a very shadow-flavored race. Kind of ties into the first assassin we did who had a very low hit point. I think he had wizard hit points. So just tying to the idea of shadow is a magic, as a source of magic. If you think of Fae being very verdant, shadow is more attuned to death,
right,
decay. It's not the most physically vital of power sources. So it's really just kind of tying into that flavor. Mm-hmm. And I think the racial power is at will, so there's a little bit of a balancing act there. So
As I say, that's my first negative, so I don't know if that'd be a model for future races as far as designing to allow negatives back in.
Yeah, we use it if it felt appropriate.
Yeah, there's something that, I don't know, I thought that Mike might have said this publicly, but it might have just been a conversation we were talking about, where when 4th edition came out, we had a narrower view of, here's the things that we want this to be, here's the kinds of things we want to focus on for classes, for characters, for feats, for class features. And the conversation I was having with Mike was that we want to focus on what makes the game fun and what seems cool for whatever the thing is that we're working on. And then beyond that, we don't want to restrain ourselves too much.
Yeah,
exactly. So the focus is really on what's fun and what fits this theme, this idea, this cool thing that we're trying to do. And not be too worried about what we can't do X, Y, or Z.
Yeah.
Fire
away.
Heroes of Shadow has more of a darker tint. Is there anything in the book that talks about how to have an evil group of party working together, because with the power source and the classes, people would tend to lead towards...
Not in that product.
Okay.
I know, let's do it at that.
But
we've already talked about it a little bit.
You should talk.
There is another product on the schedule where we will deal with that, and the author of said product is somewhere in this room.
Dun-dun-dun.
Yeah, we have any more questions, or did I call it there? We answered absolutely everything you ever wondered about D&D. Alright, I guess we did. So we should never expect any questions.
The Twitterverse is going to be mad at you for not asking my questions. They're not going to be mad at me. You. I'm going to point the fingers. Just so you know.
No, okay. They're going to be mad at you.
I know.
They should be. You earned it.
Twitter is actually pretty much.
Yeah, we only have 5:40, so yeah, we spent almost 100 minutes here.
Cool. Yeah. Well, thank you everybody for coming. That was awesome. Hopefully you got your questions answered.
Yeah.